We're going to start a new series today, and if you missed last week, I'd encourage you to, you know, go online. And my son-in-law Rocky taught, and he taught about depression, and he had some great insight into, you know, depression that our world's going through right now. And but we're going to start a new series, and I said to someone as they were coming in, I said, we're going to start the book of Ruth, but we're not going to get very far today. And they said, well, like, that surprises us. So, but we are going to jump into this book of Ruth. And how many of you have never read the book of Ruth? Or let me do it a different way, just so that maybe, you know, like, I don't want to admit that. How many of you have read Ruth? Raise your hand. Okay, so a bunch of you have read Ruth. It's this simple little book. It's four chapters long. And it's been called one of the, you know, kind of the great writings of history. And it's a love story. We won't get into the love part today, but it's a love story. And a little bit weird to us. There's some things that happen in it that we go, okay, what's that all about? You know, so there's a little bit of things because they're cultural things from 3,500 years ago. And Ruth, the book of Ruth, is set during the time of what's called the Judges in the Bible. And I'll explain that to you in a few minutes if you've never read, you know, that far in the scriptures. I'll explain, you know, the time period. But it was in the time period of Judges, and there's all of this stuff that happens. And again, it's very simple little book, and it's a great book to read. And it's told mostly through conversation. You know, different than other books where, you know, you'd get all these descriptions of everything that's going on. The book of Ruth, more than half of the book of Ruth, is actually conversation. It's a dialogue between Ruth and her mother and Ruth and Boaz and all these different people that are involved. The story is told, the account is told through dialogue. What's interesting is for a long time there's some people we'll encounter, because Ruth is what's called a Moabite, so she's from the tribe or the people of Moab. And for a long time, people believed that Moab was just a fictitious thing that the Israelites had made up because they made up another one of these stories. Until the mid-1800s, they uncovered what's called today the Moabite tablet. And it's about 4 foot tall. You might think of it as like a headstone. It's about 4 feet tall. It's black granite. Inscribed across it is all about the Moabite people, and actually records some of it. It actually has to do with their interaction with the Israelites. And so it was this archaeological evidence that was just dug up in an archaeological dig, and all of a sudden, okay, well, I guess they didn't just make up the Moabites. They were real people. And that's just happening over and over again. If you follow anything in the news about biblical archaeology, it's incredible what's happening right now in biblical archaeology as they just uncover one thing after another that validates the history of the scriptures, that they can be trusted. So anyway, that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about for the next few weeks the life of Ruth. But in order for you to understand the magnitude of this woman, and actually Naomi, but also Ruth, in order to understand the magnitude of their lives and what went on and, you know, their commitment, you kind of got to understand the context. You got to understand what's going on. So that's really what we're going to talk about, is the context which this story takes place in. So, and some of it, you know, I'm gonna give you a reading assignment, just because some of it I just don't want to talk about in public, because there's some, you know, in the context, and I'll just let you read it, and you'll get like, oh wow, that was crazy stuff. And but here's what it goes in the book of Ruth, verse 1. It says, in the days when judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and 2 sons with him. So he says, in the days of judges, or in the days when the judges ruled. So let me explain that to you. You all know the story, or most of you know, everybody would be familiar with the story of Moses leading the children of Israel out of Egypt. So he leads the children of Israel out of Egypt. They go through the Red Sea and all, you know, all that happens. And then for 40 years, they wander in the wilderness because they disobeyed God. God told them to do certain things. They wouldn't do it. You know, they're like rebellious kids. And God says, okay, well then, you know, you disqualified yourself from getting into the promised land. So for 40 years, they wandered in the wilderness. They actually wandered in the wilderness until the men, so adult men, who had come out of Egypt had all died. And once all of them were dead, you know, just imagine that. You know, you're going to have a timeout until all your, like your dads are all dead. And once your dads are all dead, then okay, then we'll move forward. And so they had this time out of wandering in the wilderness until all of the adult men had died. And once the adult men died, it's time to go across into the promised land. But because of all, not because of, it was kind of an excuse, but because of all, I'll say it that way, because of everything that had happened during those 40 years, when it came about time for them to cross into the across the Jordan River into Israel, the promised land, Moses was so ticked at the people as the leader. He was so ticked at them for everything they did. God told him to what? To speak to the rock, and what did he do? He hit the rock. He smacked the rock, and he smacked the rock in anger. And God said, because you smacked the rock instead of obeying me and speaking to the rock, you don't get to go into the promised land. Okay? And where they were at the time, which just seemed really harsh, but where they were at the time is they were in Moab. That's where they were when that all occurred, the place that Ruth is going to come from. And so he says, okay, and you can't go to the promised land, but you know what you can do? I'll take you up to Mount Nebo, which is the tallest mountain that you could see from there. You could see Israel. And so took him to Mount Nebo and took him up and said, okay, look over there, see over there. That's where the promised land is. You can't go there because you didn't obey me and you didn't treat me as holy before the people. That's what it's about. You didn't treat me as holy before the people, so you can't go in. And then, so after Moses dies, then Joshua takes over, and Joshua leads the children of Israel across the promised land, and they actually leave from Acacia Grove, what's called the Acacia Grove, in Moab. That's where they cross the Jordan River, and they cross into the promised land, and they get into the promised land, and, you know, Jericho happens, and then, you know, Ai, and all these things that, you know, that are found in the book of Joshua. And during that time period, then the land got all divided up. People took possession, and they, you know, fought against the various peoples that were in the land, all this stuff that happened. And the people were somewhat faithful. Somewhat. That's a loose word. Like all in small letters or maybe micro letters. Somewhat faithful to the Lord during the time that they were in, Joshua was alive. Here's how it goes on, though. And this is from the book of Joshua. And this is the end. Joshua's, so I'm taking you, I'm really fast through a bunch of history. But Joshua's about to die. He knows his time is up. Here's what Joshua says. It's found in Joshua, I think, 24. It says, fear the Lord. I'm starting right in the middle of a dialogue. It says, fear the Lord and serve him wholeheartedly. This is Joshua talking to the children of Israel. Put away forever the idols of your ancestors' worship when they lived beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt. Serve the Lord alone. For if you refuse to serve the Lord, then choose today who you will serve. Would you prefer the gods of your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates? Or will it be the gods of the Amorites in whose land you now are, which is Moab? But as for me and my family, we will serve the Lord. Kind of a famous line of Joshua. Some of you have heard that before. You've seen it on bumper stickers and so on. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So he's challenging the people. Who are you going to serve? Are you going to serve God, or are you going to serve all these other gods and idols and all the things you've served? And here's what the people say. It says, the people replied, we would never abandon the Lord and serve other gods. For the Lord our God is the one who rescued us and our ancestors from slavery in the land of Egypt. He performed mighty miracles before our very eyes. As we traveled through the wilderness among the enemies, he preserved us. It was the Lord who drove us out, drove out the Amorites and the other nations living in the land. So we too will serve the Lord, for he alone is God. I mean, they tell this whole testimony. God's done this, and God did this, and God took care of us, all this whole thing. He says, they're just right behind everything that's God done. And notice how they start. They said, we would what? Never. We would never. You know, those are dangerous words. Those are really dangerous words. Anytime someone says, we would never or I would never, it's dangerous territory. Everybody know what I'm talking about? Because it really is. I would never do that. Oh, right circumstances, you would do that. The right things happen in your life, you would do that. Some of you that have been around for years, you've heard me say before, you know, any one of us in this room are fooling ourselves if we think we would never do that. Because all of us in this room really could be two or three choices away from finding ourselves in positions where we would have never imagined we would have found ourselves, but there we would be. We start spending too much time with this person at work, and all of a sudden, we would never get some painkillers because of a backache or a knee surgery or whatever it happens to be. And next thing we know, we find ourselves, I would never get addicted to painkillers. And then we find ourselves addicted to painkillers. Everybody with me? I mean, the words, I would never or we would never, they're really dangerous words. You should keep them from your vocabulary. Anybody with me? You should keep them from your vocabulary, okay? Because they are statements of, I just think they're statements of extreme arrogance to say, well, I would never do what they did. We're fooling ourselves. They're words of self-deception is what they are. They're words of self-deception that we've deceived ourselves into thinking that somehow we're better than them and that if they were as good as us, they would have never done that. But because they're not as good as us, they did that, but I would never do that because I'm just better than they are. And we fooled ourselves into thinking that when the reality is they're just dangerous words. We would never. We would never. And so it goes on. So then Joshua, this is the same dialogue. This is the same conversation. We will serve the Lord. Joshua says this. He warned the people, you're not able to serve the Lord. You can't do it. How would you like to have a pastor who just led that way? I'm telling you, I'm going to serve the Lord. And you're like, yeah, we're going to serve the Lord. And he looks at you, and I look at Rocky and go, Rocky, you're not going to do it. Why do you say that? You're not going to do it. It's not going to happen. Here's what he said. He says, you are not able to serve the Lord, for he is holy and he is a holy and jealous God, and he will not forgive your rebellion and your sins. If you abandon the Lord and serve the other gods, he will turn against you and destroy you, even though he has been so good to you. We sing that song. He's been so, so good. But the people answered, no, we will serve the Lord. And you are a witness to our decision. And Joshua said, you've chosen, you've made the choice. You're going to serve the Lord. You're going to serve the Lord. And it says, yes, we are witnesses to what we have said. All right, Joshua said, destroy the idols among you and turn your hearts to the Lord, the God of Israel. And the people said to Joshua, we'll serve the Lord. Notice what they didn't say. What did they not say? We'll destroy the idols. They go, no, we'll serve the Lord. We'll keep those things. You know, we'll keep that bottle up on the cupboard above the stove, but I'm going to serve the Lord. And he says, destroy your idols. Destroy your idols, is what he said. And Joshua says, so Joshua made a covenant. We will serve the Lord and obey the people, said. Joshua made a covenant with the people that day, and he committing them to follow the decrees. And Joshua recorded them in the book, which I'm reading right now, as a reminder of the agreement. And he took a stone, this great big stone, and he set it beside the temple. And he said, the tabernacle. And he said, you know what? This will serve as the tabernacle was their traveling temple. He set it there, and he said, this will serve as a sign between you and us, you and God, that you said you're going to serve him. Then it goes on, chapter 24. It says, the people of Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and the elders who outlived him, those who had personally experienced all that the Lord had done for Israel. It says the people served the Lord as long as Joshua was alive and all of the other people that were helped leading, all the people who had experienced God doing something in their life. All those people. And then it says, and after Joshua sent the people away, each of the tribes left to take possession of their land, allotted to them, and the Israelites served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua. Same idea. This is in the book of Judges now. This is how the judges start. And it says, through the lifetime of Joshua and the leaders who outlived him, those who had seen the great things the Lord had done for Israel. Again, that the people that experienced God having done something in their life. And, you know, I could spend a whole Sunday on this, but you just can't underestimate or overspeak how important it is that God does something in people's lives. You know, that people have an encounter with God, that God makes himself real to them. And if God makes himself real to them, it's hard for them to turn. But people who just make a mental assent, yeah, I'm going to obey the Lord, then and so you should be praying for your kids that they'd have an encounter with God. You should be praying for your grandkids that they'd have an encounter with God. You should be praying for your parents or your grandparents or whatever it happens to be, they'd have an encounter with God. Jimmy, is it okay if I mention your dad? You know, a few years ago, Jimmy's dad moved down here from Alaska, and mom had health problems, and dad had health problems, and went into the hospital, and the doctors discovered that he had this rare bone disease, or blood disease. He started having transfusions every day and so on. And one day, I had been visiting someone in the hospital, not Jimmy's dad, but I'd been visiting someone over there, and I was driving on Rucker, and my phone rung, and so I pulled over there by the fire station, if you know where that's at on Rucker, and pulled over by the fire station, and Jimmy said, you know, here's what's going on with my dad. I said, well, I'll go back and visit him. So I went back, and I sat down with Bob, Jimmy's dad, and I said, this is just what came to me. He was a banker. He spent his life as a banker. I said, you know, as a banker, you know, people would come, you know, come to the place where their balloon payment is due. And if they don't pay their balloon payment, they lose it. They lose their house, whatever it happens to be. And I said, Bob, you got a balloon payment coming. You got a balloon payment coming with Jesus. And because you are hours, days, whatever it is, away from going to see Jesus. But I said, but Bob, here's the great thing. Jesus died upon the cross to pay your balloon payment. That's why he died. He died to pay your balloon payment. And I said, Bob, do you want Jesus to pay your balloon payment? And he said, I do. And so I prayed with him in the hospital room that he would just surrender his life to Jesus. Now, here's the interesting thing, and I don't know what all transpired, but here's the interesting thing is Jimmy's brother went to visit his dad and then called Jimmy later and said, Jimmy, I don't know what's happened to dad, but he's different. There's something different about him. Well, I think it's because he encountered something with God right there kind of on his deathbed. On his deathbed. He knew that his balloon payment had been paid. Isn't that awesome? I mean, somebody should say, hallelujah, or something. I mean, that's just it. Though, when someone... I mean, there are hours, days, whatever it was. I don't remember, Jimmy. You probably remember a week, whatever it was. A few days away from Bob's life ending. But his balloon payment was paid. See, again, I could spend a whole Sunday. I'll keep going. Next slide then. It says, after that generation died. So the generation of Joshua, the generation who had led with him and who had seen the things the Lord did. It says, after that, a generation died, and another generation grew up who did not acknowledge the Lord or remember the mighty things he had done for Israel. So this generation died, and the next thing you know, there's this whole generation that's now alive that knows nothing about what God did or what God could do, and they had no encounter with God. And so the book of Joshua is this roller coaster of where the people, I mean, haywire. They went haywire, and their lives would be so messed up. Their nation was so messed up. And then they would call out to God, and God would rescue them. And then next thing you know, it's just a short period of time, and they're right back in the thick of all this, you know, idol worship and worship of other gods and so on. And they dove deep into the worship of Baal, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute. But Chemosh and Molech and the image of the Ashtaroth. Here's what Judges 10 says. And again, the Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight. They served the images of Baal and the Asherah and the gods of Aram and Sidon and Moab and Ammon and Philistia. And they abandoned the Lord and no longer served him at all. They didn't deny spiritual reality. They just turned their back on God and started worshiping all the other gods that were, you know, that were around and were available. I'm hoping to help you understand, you know, what that was all about. But here's what it goes on to say. It says, in those days, this is at the end of Judges, two passages. It says, in those days, Israel had no king, had no leader, and all the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. That everybody became a law unto themselves. They determined what was right, what was wrong, what could be done, what should be done, what shouldn't be done. And they became their own rulers. They became their own dictators. They became the ones who determine right and wrong. You know, there's a significant ways that life 3,500 years ago was different than ours. I mean, we can't even imagine, in some ways, what life was like back then. Just survival. You know, the food they would eat, getting their food, you know, how they preserve food, if they could even preserve food, the houses they lived in, the weather that, you know, all the famines and all of these things that came down. You know, they just, you know, we can in some ways kind of imagine a little bit of it because we got the Bible and we got, you know, history and we watched some movies and so on. But you know, I mean, it was just, it's like this. It's like this. We can maybe have a little bit of an understanding of what they were going through, but if they saw our life, they would think they just got dropped by someone onto another planet. I mean, the houses would, I mean, that we're going to go out and get in a car and turn the key and then drive home. Even the 3 miles it is to my house, they had to walk 3 miles. It took them an hour, you know, whatever it was that it took. I mean, just grocery shopping. You just go, you know, you take your bags out now and you put them in the car and drive home with your bags. There was no grocery shopping. There was the market. And they all lived this agricultural life and trying to just sheer survival is what they were looking for. So there were some ways that they were, it was so different. But there's ways that it's real similar. You know, in that time period, life was hard. Famine, storms, natural disasters, all those things were commonplace. And people literally, they were just trying to survive. Now, when we say, for the most part, we say, how's life going? Well, I'm surviving. Just trying to survive. When we say we're trying to survive, what we're talking about is we're hoping we can pay our mortgage payment, or we're hoping to buy the next bigger, you know, like the 64-inch TV. I don't even know how big TVs are now, but, you know, the 64-inch TV or whatever. I mean, that's what we mean by we're surviving. Back then, when they said we're surviving, they're meaning we're hoping we're alive to eat another meal tomorrow. That's oftentimes what they're talking about. Not only because of their circumstances, but because of all the tribal wars that were going on and all that stuff. I mean, for survival for them is like, maybe we'll live another day. Maybe we could live for one more day. That was what survival was like for them. And because of agriculture, and they were so dependent upon the weather and the land, the people were engrossed in figuring out the secret sauce of having their land be more productive. Okay, that's what they were worried about. How do we help our land? You know, we're farming this little garden out behind our house, and that little garden, you know, if we could just get it to be produce a few more radishes or a few more lettuce, heads of lettuce, or a few more grapes or whatever it is, then maybe we can make it to, you know, another week. Maybe we can make it through this season if we could just, you know, convince the land and we could convince the gods. Because in their mind, all the weather whole thing, I mean, we look at it, that's just all nature. I mean, it's funny that we call it Mother Nature, but anyway, that's a whole other subject. But it's just nature and famine and earthquakes and natural disasters, all those things. But in their mind, all of those things were dependent upon or controlled by the gods. That's in their mind, in their world, and in most tribal places, you know, half the world's population today, they still have, I mean, there's Rocky and Wendy sitting right there. The people that you worked with, at least when you first went to work with them, and all the tribes that are around, they just, all of that, the earthquake, the lightning, the storms, they're all because of the gods. So we got to figure out how to make the gods happy. We got to figure out how to please the gods. That's what we got to figure out how to do. And so they would go through all these different things of worship, trying to figure out what god to worship, how do they worship, you know, all those things that somehow we could get the gods to be on our side. And they'd produce more food. And if they produce more food, then maybe my kids could grow up. You know, I mean, just that's what they looked at, how they looked at it. So these gods that were familiar to them at the time were Baal and Molech and Chemosh and Ashtoreth and so on. And they controlled the elements. Have you ever noticed, if you're reading the scriptures or you're watching some movie, how the temples were always put on kind of up on a hill somewhere? You know, they never put them down in the valley. It's like the temples were up on the hillside, you know, the high places and so on. That was because they were hoping that what went on in the temple, somehow the gods could get a glimpse, you know, like the gods would, somehow it would get the gods' attention of what was going on. Because the gods couldn't see down into here, but they could see what was happening on up in the temple on the top of the hill. Okay? So that's why they built the temples up there, hoping to get God to kind of glance over and see what they were doing. And they believed that what went on in the temple was a form of prayer to the gods. So if they wanted their ground to be more fertile, that's where all the immorality and orgy and all the temple prostitution, all that stuff, and I won't go into detail, but that's where all that came into. if all of that was going on in the temple on the top of a hill and God could look down, then somehow we're praying and we're instructing the gods who they could do, you know, supernatural spirit, whatever, you know, let your mind in order to make the ground more fertile. Okay, I'll just leave it at that, okay? Does everybody understand the picture? That's what was going on. And if you, as a reading assignment, if you really want to know a little bit of what, kind of what's going on, read the end of Judges, Judges 19, 20, and 21, and you'll go, no way. No way that people would do this. And if you've never read it, you'll probably shock you. At what I mean, because they were trying to get the God's attention in all of this. And, you know, of course, we live in a different world, and we don't get involved in all those crazy patterns of trying to figure out, you know, how do we get the gods to make our land more fertile? Because most of us, we don't farm enough to worry about. I mean, we just get some fertilizer and, you know, compost and, you know, all the whole, you know, or we just go to the grocery store. But you know what we do? Is we try to figure out how to get the gods or God to make our wallets more fertile. Don't we? I mean, we try to figure out what the secret sauce of having a fatter wallet is. What is that? What's that secret sauce? You know, and like, you know, one of the latest secret sauces is to get into Bitcoin or the whole site, you know, that whole cryptocurrency. I mean, we could talk all day. And if you're in cryptocurrency, that's your business. It's your money. I mean, it's really not. It's God's money, and he could take it away from you. And he might in cryptocurrency. But anyway, that. I didn't really say that, did I? I mean, but the reality is we are all looking for ways, people are, trying to figure out what's the secret sauce of making our wallet more fertile. Because, what did it say? That everyone did what was what? What was right in their own eyes. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And so we bow down to economic principles and monetary policies and bargaining and commerce and trade. And you know, now one of the big ones is socialism. You know, that socialism's the answer for America. And, you know, there's all kinds of young people jumping on the socialism bandwagon. I mean, there's just all kinds of ways that people try to figure out what's the secret sauce to getting our wallets more fertile. And so we're even though we say that we're, you know, well, we don't do that stuff. Well, we do that stuff. Here's what Gerald Leonard says. He says this: the average Christian today sees religion primarily in terms of the help which God can give him or her in this world, with a vague expectation for the world to come. To put it crudely, it's an attitude which regards God in terms of usefulness rather than an object of adoration and love. Ouch. Ouch. I mean, instead of seeing God as someone to adore and to love, we kind of just see God as Santa Claus. You know, he's the guy at the store, and maybe he'll give us a discount, or maybe he'll, you know, maybe we can win the lottery ticket or whatever it happens to be. Just what can God do for me? Instead of like, okay, I'm supposed to adore him and I'm supposed to love him and serve him. It's about what God can do for us. See, today we worship, these are some of the gods we worship today. How about individual freedom and rights? Everyone did what was what? It was right in their own eyes. See, we don't want anyone telling us what to do. We want instead our own individual freedom. Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to do. Or self-centered consumerism, or prosperity, or the endless quest for happiness. And self-will is running the show. Or one of the signs of that today that we're kind of living, because again, what everyone did what was right in their own eyes. One of the big ways of that is this whole idea of my truth and your truth. Just the whole idea that, you know what, I get to be the arbitrator of truth. Well, you can fool yourself into thinking you're the arbitrator of truth, but you're not the arbitrator of truth. You can say 2 plus 2 equals 5. We've talked about that. You can say 2 plus 2 equals 5 like 1984 once, you know, the whole story around that idea. You can do that, but 2 plus 2 still equals what? Yeah, good. Nobody said five. Good. Because we were going to, you know, get the deacons to haul you out. No, 2 plus 2 equals 4. So you can say, well, it's my truth. Well, that's your truth, Pastor Matt. No, 2 plus 2 equals 4. This whole idea, my truth, your truth, it's just this huge indicator of everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Everybody would decide for themselves what was right. Everyone would determine. And the eye doesn't get to determine truth. The eye doesn't get to determine what's right and what's wrong. The eye doesn't get to determine that. Are you all with me? So we can say, well, we don't live like that. But we are living, and this is like going back to the thing we just went through of living in a Daniel world. We're living in a Ruth world, where everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. I mean, if you have that set of glasses on, you read the news today, you'll go, oh, well, they're doing what's right in their own eyes. That's doing what's right in their own eyes. And it's easy to pick it out in other people, but where it's hard is what? In our own lives. Am I making this rule up for me? Am I thinking I can get away with this, even though everyone else is? You know, am I the dictator of this? I'm going to skip that. I'm going to go to this is the famous verse. What time is it? This is the famous verse out of the book of Ruth. And so we'll get into the story next week. But Naomi and her husband and two boys go to Moab, and because there's a famine in Bethlehem, in the region of Bethlehem. Yes, that's the same Bethlehem where Jesus was born. There's a famine there. They go to Moab, trying to find, you know, a solution to this. And while they're there, the two boys get married, and then the dad dies, and the two boys die, and it's Naomi left with Ruth and Oprah is there left with. And that's where the story, you know, kind of picks up. And here's the famous line. It says, this is Ruth talking to Naomi. It says, don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be married. And probably some in the room had this verse at their wedding. This was a verse that was at their wedding. You know, where you go, I will go. Where you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die. And there, it says, I will be buried. And then she goes on, may the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us. That was Ruth's cry. That was the throb of Ruth's heart. Because wherever you go, Naomi, I'm going with you. And whatever, your God's going to be my God, and I'm going to serve right alongside of you. And she made that commitment, and she made that pledge. She made that the cry of her heart, in the middle of a world where everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And part of what we're going to see in this love story is this incredible devotion of a woman and women and a man, this incredible devotion to do what was right in the middle of a world where everyone did what was right in their own eyes, where everyone was a law unto themselves, where everyone determined for themselves how committed they were going to be, what they were going to be committed to. Ruth says, no, I'm going to go where you go, and your God's going to be my God, and we're going to be together until death do us part. I mean, that's the whole idea. Now, I don't know what, about you, and you know, we'll get into this next week, but I don't know about you, but I, in the middle of a world where everyone's doing right, what's right in their own eyes, in the middle of a world where there's my truth and your truth, in the middle of a world where I'm the determining factor of what sexual morality is supposed to be, what financial morality is supposed to be, what honesty, dishonesty, lying, you know, white lies, all, I mean, in all of the stuff that's going on in our world right now, all of the stuff that's going on, my heart cry, and I hope your heart cry would become, or is my heart cry too, is, Lord, wherever you go, that's where I'm going. Whatever you do, that's what I'm doing. You know, you take out Ruth and take out Naomi, that I would be saying to God, God, wherever you go, whatever you're doing, I'm going to be there. I will be there. I will be there. I want to be a part of whatever you're doing. And wherever you go, wherever you live, I will live. And your people are my people. That's what the church is all about. That people who are part of a church, you're my people. And I'm your people. Right? I mean, that's what this is supposed to be. And it's so easy in the world we're living in today to go, no, you know, I'm just a Christian who, I go to that church. No. God's plan is that you and I, your people would be my people. My people would be your people. We would say, I'm committed to this church. I'm committed to this group of people. And wherever that happens to be, wherever God lands you, that there would be some semblance until God says, okay, now I got something else for you. But during that time, it would be your people or my people. Are you with me? That your people are my people. That would be our heart cry. Again, we're living in a world where self is determining everything. And self is not to be the determining factor. We sang that the name today that's supposed to be the determining factor. What's that name? It's the name of Jesus. He's the one that's supposed to be the determining factor. Lord, all of us in this room know what it means to wrestle with wanting to be the determining factor. Where we argue with our spouse over what restaurant we're going to go to for dinner because I want this and she wants that and I want my way. And so next thing you know, we have a fight and dinner's miserable because we want to be in charge. The I determining it all. Lord, keep working in our hearts, keep working in our spirits till we all come to this place where we would say, like Ruth said, wherever you go, there I'll go. Wherever you live, that's where I'm going to live. That your people will be my people. Lord, that we would have, in the middle of a world where everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes, we would have a heart of commitment and devotion that would be like Ruth's and like Naomi's and like Boaz, where we would be committed to do what you want us to do. Because you are the determiner, Jesus, of it all. So help us, Lord. Help us, Jesus. And those that aren't there right now, God, wrestle with them until they get to that place. Those that have had in their mind the idea, I'll never, Lord, wrestle with them about that. And Lord, those of us that find ourselves maybe more susceptible than others to try and fertilize our wallet, Lord, again, help us not to make our wallet the determiner of what we do and how we treat people. But we would make you would be the determiner. So help us, Jesus. Keep transforming our lives. Can you say amen? Amen. God bless you. Have a great afternoon. If you got something you want prayer for, there's some folks that will be up here. They'd love to pray with you. Don't leave here without getting prayer. Those of you that are online, thanks for joining us today. Again, read Judges 19:20 and 21. God bless you. Have a great afternoon.